Once you were all back inside the bank and ditch of the road camp, Moat slid down from the horse he'd been riding, strode over to where Eru had just dismounted, and struck him in the face. "Get your sword out so I can kill you," Moat said coldly, and drew his own.
"What, because I was right?"
Eru protested, drawing his. "The moment the Tell knew you were upon them, they sent someone to be sure of the sacrifice," said Moat, neither raising his voice nor lowering his sword. "Had he succeeded, you'd have faced a vastly more powerful opponent. He nearly did succeed. If you had only waited a few minutes longer, as I ordered you, all of this would have been done much more easily."
"You were never in any danger," Eru argued. "The raven always looks out for you."
"And he'll look out for me now," said Moat. Another Lord Sun came up to Eru, took his arm, whispered urgently in his ear.
"My lord," you said, having come up beside Moat, your voice still hoarse from the smoke. "If you kill Lord Eru, we'll probably lose most of the men from the northwestern districts. That's if we're lucky, and they just leave rather than attacking us."
"Luck will have nothing to do with it," said Moat coldly.
"My lord Lys's heir?"
said Eru stiffly, his companion still holding tight to his arm.
"I spoke in error.
He swallowed and began again through gritted teeth.
"I apologize."
"Your apology does no good," replied Moat, "if you won't follow orders."
"I mistakenly thought I saw your signal,"
Eru lied, his jaw still tense.
"I will be more careful in future."
You opened your mouth to say something to Moat, but reconsidered. After a few moments, Moat lowered his sword.
"Get out of my sight," he said.
That had been a year and a half earlier. Now you were in Vastai, still sitting outside Mawat's room in the fortress. By evening, he had not emerged, and the milk had indeed gone sour, as the servant had predicted. You drank it anyway. Then, after some consideration and a shrug, you ate the bread and one of the sausages and leaned back against the door once more. You were eyeing another of the sausages when the swish of silks in the stairway made you look up. Zazume, her blue robes black in the corridor's twilight, tall, stately, came to the doorway and stopped before you. She gave the tray of food with its empty milk bowl a sharp glance.
"Has he been out, then? Have you gotten him to eat something?"
"No, mother," you said, scrambling to your feet, surreptitiously wiping one sausage-greasy hand on your trousers under your cloak.
"Ah," said Suzume, "you've been here all day, have you? You're his aider here. Can you ordinarily get him to eat when he's like this? Do you have any influence over him at all?"
"Not really, mother." Suzume sighed, and you added, "I've never known him to be like this for long. He usually comes out of it in a couple of hours."
"Really?" Suzume asked, visibly surprised. "You've had some experience of his temper, then, and you're not afraid to be here when he does come out."
It was your turn to be surprised.
"No, mother."
Suzume gave you an appraising look.
"You're a very pretty young man, even if you do sound like a farmer."
I think it took you a moment to understand what she meant.
"Excuse me, mother. I don't think I'm the sort of man Lord Mowat might be interested in that way."
"Damn," said Suzume, clearly disappointed. "I was hoping maybe you would be able to calm him down." She sighed then. "It's a difficult situation. I understand that he's angry,
and I warned the Lys that this would happen. But there was never going to be any good way to break the news, and it's not as though Mowat has lost anything. He's still the heir.
Unless the Lys names another one, you said. I think you hesitated just a bit before you said the Lys, as though you weren't sure if Hibal really was that.
I hardly think that's likely, replied Zezume crisply. What arrangements has Mowat made for your lodging?
He didn't have a chance to make any, mother.
Zezume sighed again. No, of course not. Well, you can't slip in front of his door like a dog. Go to Gisette and tell her that Zezume said she's to find you somewhere to sleep, not in the hall. I don't think that will do. And besides, I don't think there's any room there, but somewhere nearby. She has an office at the back of the hall, and if she's not there, you'll find her in one of the storerooms. And tell her she's to give you a chit for the kitchens, so that you can come and go and get breakfast and dinner.
Well, yes, mother. Thank you, mother.
Come back in the morning, if you like, said Zezume. I think he's not coming out for several days, and he won't open the door to take food unless he's sure no one is in the corridor.
She frowned, seeing your expression.
That surprises you.
It's as I said, mother. He usually calms down within a few hours, sooner if there's an alarm, and he's fine when he comes out.
Mostly fine.
An alarm? Said Zezume, realizing.
I see. He can hardly command the border defence if he's spending days locked in his room, can he? It seems he's learned to master himself better, at least a bit, which is all to the good. But this... There are no alarms to call him out of his room here, and this is a terrible blow. His father, I would never have believed it. I would never have thought the Lys would...
She seemed unable to say it, and leave us in a crisis like this. Zezume shook her head.
I understand that Mowat is angry, I understand why, but we couldn't leave things as they were. We had to secure a new Lys immediately.
She gave you a shrewd look. Don't try to convince him of that when he does come out. It will only end badly for you.
I'll talk to him myself. I've known him since he was a baby. And he'll listen to me. Eventually.
Yes, mother, you said. You found Gisette in a small wooden hut built hard up against the back end of the long, high-roofed hall, more a storeroom than anything else, crowded with piles of wood-cased wax tablets and chests carved from tree trunks and circled with strips of iron. Gisette was only slightly younger than Mother Zezume and kept her grey hair in a single thick braid pinned to the top of her head. Keys and styluses hung and jangled behind the rough-woven apron she wore over her dull green skirts. At first, she refused to give you any quarters but a pallet in the hall, once the tables had been cleared away for the night. But when she heard that Zezume had ruled out your sleeping there, Gisette grudgingly gave you a token to take a house outside the fortress gates. And then, after a few moments of doubtful consideration, opened one of the chests and pulled out two more chits, each a polished rectangle of wood, marked on one side with a few lines and curves of inlaid copper, each one notched on two edges and a leather cord tied around, looped so that they could be hung on a wrist or a neck.
"One to let you pass through the gate into the fortress, and the other for meals, 2 meals a day," Gisette admonished, frowning. "Only 2, not 2 at your lodgings and 2 here. They send me the account so I'll know."
"Yes, ma'am," you replied, with the air of someone who had met her sort before and knew better than to argue or contradict her.
"I wouldn't give you both, except Mother Zezume said so, and I'm not about to argue with her, but you can be sure I'll show her the accounts if I need to."
She held the chits out by their cords.
"Yes, ma'am,"
you said again, and took them.
The Lady Tikaz came briskly into the room, heedless of your presence, stepping neatly around a stack of tablets that you'd nearly tripped over when you'd come in.
"Auntie," she said,
If there are eels tomorrow, my father would like some. I'm saying so now before everyone else gets them all.
As soon as she'd entered, you ought to have looked down at the floor, or at least politely away. But instead, you were staring at her.
She turned her sharp-featured face to stare back at you, took in the leather cords of the chits trailing from your hand, your rough-spun clothes, your one gold arm ring, the gold hilt of your knife.
Who are you?
You looked hastily down.
My name is Aeolo, lady. I came with the Lord Mawat.
Whatever for?
Asked Tikas.
He's the Lord Mawat's aide,
put in Giset, when you didn't answer immediately.
So a servant, but too good to fetch food for his master, or to be any use to anyone else otherwise.
Tikas scoffed.
Is Mawat sleeping with you, then?
There was an uncomfortable silence. Then you looked up, looked Tikas directly in the eye and said,
Would you be jealous if he was?
Tikas scoffed again.
Jealous of which one of you?
Either one, my lady. As you prefer.
I've already turned Mawat down a dozen times, and I'll turn him down again if he needs it. And as for you...
For some reason, you didn't want her to finish that sentence.
I came here to get these,
you broke in, and hefted the lodging token and the bits of wood on their cords.
At Mother Suzume's direction? I've been travelling for 3 days. I'm in an unfamiliar place with no one near who I know except my lord, who is out of sorts. I only want to find supper and a place to sleep for the night. I am sorry my presence offends you, but I didn't come here to be insulted.
Well, you're a brassy one, exclaimed Giset. And listen to you, with that farmer's accent and those words in your mouth.
Excuse me, ma'am, you said to Giset. I can't help the way I talk, and I didn't start this.
Your pardon, sir,
said Tikas, after a moment.
I spoke out of turn. It isn't only Mawat who's out of sorts at the moment.
Of course, lady, you acknowledged. We all are, right now.
Tikas spun and strode out of the room in a flurry of red and green silk.
Giset said, frowning, You'll want to watch that mouth of yours, young man, especially around the lady Tikas.
I have no quarrel with the lady, you said, trying not to sound angry, I thought. If she won't trouble herself with me, there won't be any chance of my offending her.
Oh, I'm not worried about you offending her, said Giset with a frown. Would you be jealous if he was? I have eyes in my head. That lady is not someone to trifle with on her own account, and her father presides over the Council of the Directions and has the ear of the lease. You could get yourself into a world of trouble if you're not careful, and don't think I won't tell that to Mother Suzume if I need to.
I'll come tomorrow to check on the Lord Mawat, you said. If he comes out of his room, could someone send for me?
Someone will, never fear, said Giset, still frowning. Did he eat anything?
The tray was still outside his door when I left.
Well,
she made an exasperated sound.
Well, little wonder he's angry. It's a bad business. Who would have thought?
It's terrible, you agreed. How could anyone have thought? He's been lease all my life.
There was no need for you to specify who was meant by that he, that you were not talking about Hibal. You hesitated.
I don't think my lord quite believes it.
No.
Giset looked suddenly older and frightened. None of us can. Maybe you thought then of who might have ordered that bowl of fresh milk sent to Mawat. In a town, milk usually appears as cheese, or butter, or maybe thick fermented buttermilk. Fresh milk is a relative rarity. Doubtless you recognised that the tablets all around you held accounts and inventories, realised that it was Giset who managed such things, who knew day to day and hour to hour
what food there was and who needed to be fed by it. With Giset in authority over the kitchens, taking it upon oneself to set fresh milk on a tray everyone knew would sit ignored in a corridor for hours would be foolhardy indeed.
"Do you believe it, ma'am?"
you asked.
"Was there some sign of it? Looking back, I mean."
"It doesn't matter what I believe," she said with a shrewd look.
"I have work to do, and if I don't do it, the fortress goes hungry. And you should keep to your own job too."
"Yes, ma'am," you agreed. She eyed you sceptically.
"Two meals, mind?"
"Yes, ma'am," you said again, and gave her a small bow, and left. The house Giset had assigned you to was on the square outside the fortress gate, a long two-story building of stone, wood and plaster, and a thatched roof. Half the ground floor was taken up by a single large room, tables and benches stacked and pushed against the walls at this hour, a dozen pallets laid out in rows. Most of them held people sleeping, or trying to, under cloaks or blankets. There was room for a 13th, but when the landlady saw your token, her businesslike demeanour took on just a tinge of deference, and she showed you to a small room of your own, clean and bare, with a decent enough bed and a tiny window from which you could see the pale yellow stones of the fortress wall. You frowned at the sight, and then sat down on the bed and closed your eyes and sighed, and then tugged off your boots, loosened your bindings, and pulled your cloak around you and lay down, though I dare say you didn't sleep for a long while. The language the priests of the reindeer hunters taught me is a language no human being has spoken in thousands of years. Though there are people far, far to the east, across the sea, who speak a tongue that is a distant cousin of it. In addition to teaching me their language, once the priest decided she had my attention and that I more or less understood her, the people began to make regular offerings to me. Fresh reindeer milk, blood, meat, flowers, small sour yellow-pink berries, along with petitions. I took the offerings, of course, each one adding to my strength, such as it was bit by bit. I didn't know what to do with the petitions, not at first, but every time one of the reindeer hunters would make a petition and then find their wish gratified, entirely by their own efforts or by chance, as far as I knew, that person made a point of thanking me with more offerings. And every time the priest spoke, she reminded me of the power of my words. It was only a matter of time before I made the connection, and then only a matter of discovering how to speak, and in speaking to ensure the gratitude of the reindeer hunters, who would then make more offerings. Yes, they trained me as though I were a dog, with attention and treats and constant praise. But I trained them as well. They quickly learned that while I would take blood or milk or even water, what I preferred was fish from the nearby river or shells from the now distant sea. Speech was not a simple matter for me, and so over generations, between us we devised a set of tokens, bits of wood cut and polished into silhouettes of fish inset with shell, each marked with a particular emblem. A person who wished to speak with me needed only address me and then reach into a box of such tokens. It was a simple matter for me to nudge the right one into a reaching hand, or even a series of them, to be lined up on the ground and my intent interpreted. I think I was quite fond of them, though I thought more and more about the other gods they visited and spoke of among themselves. Could I move? Could I go about the world the way these people did and see the things they spoke of? If the chatter of the reindeer hunters was accurate, some other gods did move about, sometimes travelling long distances. Why had none of those other gods visited me? Well, actually, at least one had. But it had taken me a while to notice her. Hundreds of years before the reindeer-hunting people had come across me, they had found a reddish, strangely pitted stone that was far heavier than it ought to have been for its size. So far as they could tell, it was unlike any other stone in the area, though they were both wrong about that. Several other similar stones lay buried in various places nearby, and right. Those stones were all of them fragments of a single larger one. In any event, the stone was a prodigy, and the people who found it accordingly treated it as a god. I had seen that god streak across the sky, felt the earth tremble when she hit. Her arrival left a crater in the ground, even below the thickness of ice she landed on. Before she had fallen to earth, she had unceasingly travelled great distances and seen wonders. She had seen the whole earth, from far, far away, all its lands and its seas, round like a bilberry, but green and brown and blue, and much, much larger. The earth moved around and around the sun, which is itself round and immensely huger than it looks to us because it is so distant. She saw other worlds besides ours circling the sun, satisfyingly around and around, each in its own precise path. She told me that the shining stars overhead, whose regular movement I so admired, were worlds and suns themselves, so distant they appeared to be only tiny points of light. Or so she speculated aloud to me, rather unwisely. Can you imagine how much power it would take to make that statement true? But as it did not harm her to say it, and it has not hurt me to say it, I suppose it must be the case. She learned language relatively quickly, and I suppose it was only natural that, unlike me, she loved to travel, with the reindeer-hunting people or on her own. She learned early to do what I had never thought or desired to do, to take or build a body to use for travel or speech or whatever other purpose she might have. And it was she who had directed the reindeer hunters to my hillside. In Iridan, her name is a curse, but among the reindeer hunters, whose name for themselves meant something like us people, it was a blessing. They called her the Myriad, and by arrangement with the Myriad, they roamed their land almost entirely free of interference from the clouds of mosquitoes that gathered when the sun went down. But I knew none of this when I first met the Myriad. When first I realized I had met her, mosquitoes were just a part of the world around me. I didn't pay much attention to them, except to recognize their existence. They didn't trouble me, of course. I had no blood, and I was impervious to their sharp proboscises. So when my friend first visited me, I didn't see anything except maybe a slightly thicker cloud of the usual summer mosquitoes. The Myriad had travelled a great deal, and knew many fascinating stories, her own and those of others. Or I thought them fascinating. She in her turn was fascinated by my tales of bony-headed fish and trilobites, the long, slow retreat of the sea, amphibians and bird-like reptiles, the ice that had still shrouded the land when she'd first arrived. She would visit me along with the reindeer hunters once a year, or perhaps once every few years, and we would talk for a few weeks, and then the people would move on, and she would move on with them. It was enough. I was used to being alone, preferred it, really. But the Myriad had met not only many human beings, but many gods. She had acquaintances all over the Northlands,
and had once or twice even gone as far south as the Shoulder Sea.
Here is a story I have heard. On the northern shore of the Shoulder Sea sat a permanent settlement, a camp larger than I had ever seen. It had grown into a small city, spread along part of a large natural harbour, sheltered by two small headlands. It was, moreover, located on one of the very few navigable straits between the Shoulder Sea and the open ocean. Boats passed there, boats docked there, not just the small skin boats I'd seen occasionally on the tiny river in my valley, but boats large enough to hold dozens of people. To carry timber and loads of skins and furs or anything else that was plentiful in one place but rare in another. The gods of that city received offerings on a scale I could barely imagine. Some had become intensely specialised in a way I and the myriad both found faintly ridiculous. For instance, one god concerned itself almost exclusively with the napping of stone blades, and had spent long years considering the ways flint and obsidian fractured so that it could use its power most efficiently. The petitions it received were almost entirely concerned with the manufacture, trade, or use of such items. I myself did similar services for the reindeer hunters on occasion, but if that were all I did, I would have sadly limited the offerings I received. This god, however, had grown large and powerful almost entirely on this one thing. Quite a lot of people lived on the shores of the sea. Nearly every one of those people would depend on some sort of knife or blade at some point. Another god there had spent years pondering the construction of walls. She had a plan for the city's harbour, to enlarge and extend it, to line it with stone quays and offices and warehouses. This plan would cost the city a good deal of resources and the god a good deal of effort, but the result would be more and safer space for more and larger ships. The city's, and no doubt the god's, wealth was tied to those ships, and its population had already outstripped the ability of the surrounding land to feed so many. So the god presented her plan to the people and the other gods of the city. It would take years. Years of ritual and sacrifices the gods involved were strengthened for the purpose. Then the god of walls would push back the sea and hold it, so that the engineers could lay enormous blocks of stone and build dams and hollow pillars that would let them construct enormous quays. Just moving all that water, even for a short period, would take a tremendous amount of power. Then to keep those dams and caissons safe, to move all those stones.
"But this is what the engineers are for," the myriad told me. "I gather that in course of her usual business, this god has thought a great deal about cutting and hauling stone, and the builders there have devices for moving such things, that she will only have to assist those. But even so, yes, it will take a tremendous amount of power. I imagine it will take decades to accumulate so much, if not longer."
The thought of such power reminded me of the gods I had seen so long ago, before I had met the myriad, long before humans existed, I was sure.
"Those likely will have been ancient ones," the myriad informed me,
and told me that the gods of the seacoast were afraid of the few that still lived, and afraid that the ones who had died might return. She had heard stories of a place farther south, even than the Shoulder Sea, where whole armies of ancient gods had battled. One of them had uttered a curse just before it died, and now, tens of thousands, perhaps millions of years later, the still cursed bones of its opponents lay in the ground. Anyone disturbing those bones would die horribly before the day was out. This was possible in theory. It is, of course, entirely possible to make some such statement regarding an object the bones of gods or not, to make an object a God-spoken thing. And a God's words must be true. If they are not true already, that God's power must change the world.
Or try.
There are no doubt several ways to change the world so that anyone who touches a particular object dies within the day. Perhaps the simplest seeming would be to alter the universe itself in such a way that this is always true. But simple as that sounds, changing the nature of things on such a scale would, I am certain, take far more power than any god I know of possesses. And besides that, even small changes to small things have consequences. What would such an instant, profound change mean for everything else in the world? Instead, in my experience, when a god speaks in this way concerning an object, the god's power is required only when the conditions of the speech are met. And in such cases, if that god dies, there is no longer any power to make those previous words true. And the gods concerned in this ancient battle had, I was told, been dead for millennia. But, the myriad told me, a god had said it to her, and said it unambiguously. The ancient god was dead who had uttered the curse, and yet the curse was still in effect. It must have been true. It was not the sort of thing a god could otherwise straightforwardly say with impunity, not unless that god was unimaginably powerful. There are some actions beyond the power of even the most powerful gods, and one of them is to say something happened that did not, or to say something did not happen that did. "Did that statement come by itself?" I asked, after thinking that over for a year or two, "or did it come like yours, framed with, 'A god told me straightforwardly'?" The myriad gave a buzzing whine of laughter.
"You don't move speedily, but you move to the purpose," she said. "That statement was framed with, 'A god told me,' but ultimately it must be true. If we follow back the chain of 'a god told me's,' there will be a god who first told the tale and told it without injury, since that was part of the telling."
I thought about that for a while, and then I asked how it was that these powerful, ancient ones could utter anything, since language, as far as we knew, was a human thing.
"I don't know," the myriad replied. "But it seems to me that the gods of ancient times are quite different in some ways from the gods of this age."
So it seems to me also. I think it must be so, but I do not know for certain. What I do know is that the harbour town that the myriad had visited, that was home to so many powerful, specialised gods, and had such ambitious plans for its harbour, was the place that the Eridani now call Advustia, which you can see if you stand atop the Raven Tower in Vastai and look across the strait. In the morning, you washed your hands and your mouth with herbed water. Made a face, briefly. Was it because you were used to different herbs south of the forest, or because you had become used to plain water in the field? And then murmured morning prayers to the raven, the god of Vastai, sustainer of Iriden. Then you sat down to your allotted breakfast, a flat loaf of barley bread, a hunk of cheese, small beer, at one of the long tables that had been pulled back out from the wall. Now it was day. You sat with your back as near a corner as you could, watching the door to the house, watching the landlady and her daughter come back and forth out of the kitchen, watching the other guests at their breakfasts. They were a varied lot. Two officials from across the strait in Advustia, in wool and bright-dyed silk, who had clearly slept upstairs in their own room, attended by their servant, who had slept downstairs. An assortment of men and women, prosperous farmers, to judge by the fine-woven, sober-coloured wool they wore, here in Vastai on various errands. A man in loose shirt and trousers of sky-coloured linen, who spoke with a strange accent, but was clearly at ease. Across from you, very near the fire, in their sleeveless knee-length tunics, cloaks on their shoulders, sat the Julans from the fortress. You eyed them as they leaned on the table
and chatted in a language I'm quite certain you couldn't understand. An older man who had been sitting where the farmers stood came over to where you sat. He wore good plain wool like a wealthy farmer, but over one shoulder was slung a garment of black silk embroidered with oak leaves.
"Good morning," he said to you. "My name is Dara, and I am the direction for Owenda. You are the Lord Mowat's aide? Aeolo, is it?"
"I am, Lord," you replied, setting down your beer. "How may I be of service to you?" Dara smiled, as though your greeting had been more than just appropriately polite, as though you had seemed glad to see him. "Someone said they thought you seemed as though you might be from Owenda, and to hear you speak, I think they might be right." You didn't reply to this. "One of the things I do as a direction is help the people under my authority find their way around, if they have business in Vastai. I make introductions when I can, help out with petitions or suits, that sort of thing, if it's needed. Perhaps I know your family."
"I'm not here on my own business, Lord," you said, your voice almost apologetic. Beneath a veneer of courtesy, you seemed wary, maybe even a bit frightened. Dara's smile grew wider.
"No, of course not." He sat across the table from you, shrugged the black silk robe off his shoulder, and set it in his lap. "You're here on the Lord Mowat's business. Though as he's in one of his moods just now, there's not much business for you to do, is there?"
He looked at you intently, waiting for some sort of response, and apparently seeing what he wanted in your expression, continued,
"Not that I blame him for being angry. This was surely not what he expected to find."
He did not specify what this was. He did not need to.
"Lord Direction," you said, "I don't know anything about what's going on here."
"Have you been to Vastai before?" he asked you genially, and at your gestured no, "then, to judge by your youth, you never met the Lord Mowat's father."
"The trees in the forest for Fend," you said, making a quick gesture under the table with your left hand, and then observed, "You knew him?"
"I knew him," agreed Dara, with an ironic quirk of his mouth, as though he was bitterly amused by your calling on the forest, and knew what gesture you had just made.
"Can he really have fled? Is it even possible?"
Dara frowned and considered a moment. "If you had asked me that last week, I would have said it wasn't. The last lease was..." He hesitated. "I would not say this to the Lord Mowat, you understand, but the last lease had quite a temper, and in the last few years he had ceased to rein that temper in, even with his friends, of which he had fewer and fewer. In recent years, he did not govern, but rather made demands of the directions according to his whims, which we did not always bend to, of course. The lease may rule Irridan, but only with the assistance and agreement of the Council of the Directions."
Dara waved away his last few words.
"But no lease is on the bench forever, and the instrument was aging. Everyone knew it was only a matter of time. Your Lord Mowat might have been wise to spend more time in Vastai these past few years, consulting the directions and making plain his intentions to govern Irridan responsibly."
"The Lord Mowat," you replied coldly, "has been somewhat busy, keeping the tail away from our borders."
"He has," agreed Dara, "for which we're all grateful, particularly those of us from the other side of the forest, as we two are. Who would have been in command of our forces in the south if Mowat hadn't been there? Who commands those forces now?"
"The Lord Eru," you said, managing to keep your voice bland and even.
"The Lord Eru. I know him, know of him. Hardly a great strategist, but unquestionably brave and ambitious."
He is those things,
you agreed. I see you know him too, said Dera, sardonic. But your lord might safely have left the border in his hands every now and then to show his face in Vastai, and let us all see what sort of man he had become. Let us know what to expect from his tenure on the bench.
And then, perhaps in response to the careful set of your mouth on hearing him say these things, he added,
Still, he's done well in the field, and I can't say I blame him for wanting to stay away from his father.
You frowned at that.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean, Lord Direction.
Do you not? Well, what's done is done. If the Lord Mawa has not been here to reassure us, the Lord Hibal certainly has been. Whatever my disagreements with him, the Lord Hibal is certainly less erratic than his brother. And if the Lord Mawat is angry and disappointed now, as he surely is right to be, this may work out to all of our advantages. Your lord is young, and he is still heir to the lease. With the Lord Hibal on the bench, Mawat has time to learn to moderate his temper and show us that he is not his father, and one needn't be lease to work for the good of Iridan.
Are you certain the new lease won't name a new heir?
You asked, picked up your beer slowly and deliberately, and took a drink, set the cup back down.
Especially given my lord's apparent deficiencies.
Dera laughed. Take my advice, Aolo. Don't lose your accent. Everyone here will underestimate you.
You blinked, momentarily confused, but covering it well.
But, to your question, yes, Hibal might name a new heir, but the Directions and the Mother of the Silent also have a say in such things, as does the Raven himself. Hibal can't just name an heir and be done, and some of us only agreed to support his bid for the bench now precisely because he promised that Mawat would step up to the bench after him. Some of us, despite our involvement in placing the Lord Hibal on the bench, still have misgivings. And we would like your lord to come out of his room and attend to various matters.
You stared at Dera, and then asked,
Such as?
Now that he's on the bench,
said Dera, quietly leaning forward just a bit, as though wary now of being overheard,
the Lord Hibal begins to speak of moving the Raven's household to Ardvustia.
You blinked two or three times.
What?
And that was my reaction, said Dera. The Directions have very little authority in Ardvustia. The lease rules there, or his officials rule there for him. They cross the strait to consult with him nearly every day. Of course the Directions have a say in some things even there, and of course we've all shared in the prosperity that possession of Ardvustia brings to us. The lease takes his share of the cargo of every ship that passes through the strait, and some of that flows to all the rest of Iridan through trade and gifts. And of course quite a few of us, myself included, have shares in some of those ships, and visit Ardvustia quite regularly. But with the lease gone from Vastai, how much of that wealth would still cross the strait to us? Perhaps there would be less occasion for trade and gifts. Perhaps the people with interest in Ardvustia would find it inconvenient to remain in Vastai. And over time, all the lease's attention would be centred on Ardvustia, where the Directions hold no real political power, and the council would become irrelevant to the bench. Perhaps the lease would like to make it so. Ensconce in Ardvustia, with all he needs and more, how much attention would the lease, or the Raven himself, have for matters in Iridan?
Can the lease leave Vastai without breaking the Raven's agreement with the God of the Silent?
You asked, astonished.
The Lord Hibal seems to think so. He has not, you understand, announced his intention to move across the strait.
He has only said things that suggest such a possibility. But why suggest it if he doesn't mean to attempt it, and if?"
Dara shook his head.
"If the raven has found a way to escape his obligations to the forest and abandon us, well, that move might be very bad for Iridan. I know."
He held up a forestalling hand, "that we would still have the forest. The forest was enough for us before the raven came, but things were different then."
"Do I understand, Lord Direction," you said calmly and smoothly, "that you wish me to tell my lord that you would continue to support his succession to the bench after Hybal, as long as he can assure you that he will keep the lease in Vastai?"
"Something like that," agreed Dara, "if it hasn't already occurred to him. Besides that, there is the matter of his father's disappearance. Will the raven not demand payment of his lease? The Lord Hybal has argued that the matter is dealt with, that responsibility for paying the raven falls entirely on the lease himself, and the raven will extract any required payment or punishment from the Lord Mawat's father, somehow. He seems entirely unworried about what the god might demand when this new egg hatches and the new instrument is born. I myself," he shook his head, "am not so sure. But we shall see."
"Lord Dara," you said, "if the lease didn't flee, what happened to him?"
Dara took his black silk robe from off his lap and stood.
"I hardly know, but he was searched for all through the tower and the fortress, and no one could find him, and in the end, it doesn't matter. Hybal was named lease by the Mother of the Silent, with the agreement of most of the Council of the Directions. And he sat on the bench and lived. So he is the lease now, and that is the fact we all must deal with."
He pulled the robe on, settled it over his shoulders.
"I must attend the lease. But I'm glad to know that a countryman of mine serves the Lord Mawat so faithfully. Do come speak to me if you ever need my assistance as direction for Oenda."
When Dara had gone, you finished your breakfast and then stood and pulled your cloak around yourself and stepped out of the house into the wide sunlit square, and took the two chits that Giset had given you out of your shirt and went into the fortress. Mawat's door was still closed. The tray you'd seen last night had been taken away and replaced with another one that held a bowl of now-congealed barley gruel with greens in it and a small heap of pickled turnips. It clearly hadn't been touched. You knocked on the door, waited, knocked again.
"My lord,"
you said.
"My lord, it's me, Aiolo."
There was no answer.
"Giset assigned me a place to sleep outside the fortress," you said. "If you need me, she'll send for me."
Still no answer.
"I'll check back tomorrow."
You walked the inside of the fortress wall then, or as much of it as you could. You avoided obviously staring, but it was clear to me that you were searching for something. You did look at the ravens, some of whom turned a curious eye on you as you passed, but everyone else seemed to ignore them, and none of the birds evinced any particular interest in you. Nor did anyone else in the fortress, though the guard at the entrance to the tower eyed you intently as you walked around it. And then as you stood, looking up toward its top,
"Move along,"
the guard called to you, after a few minutes of this,
"unless you have business here."
You did stare then, and asked,
How tall is it?
The guard rolled his eyes, contemptuous of your gawking.
Sneer all you like. I've never been to Vastai before.
Defensive, leaning on that accent Dara had advised you to keep.
That much is obvious, said Tikaz,
who had come up behind you, and then, more quietly,
what are you actually doing?
You gestured toward the tower.
I've never seen a building so tall.
Tikaz scoffed. You can't stop the act. Mawat would never have taken you for his aid if you were that sort of fool.
You blinked innocently at her. She continued still quietly. And I suppose you just happened to accidentally have breakfast with Lord Dera of the Council of the Directions?
And when you couldn't conceal your surprise,
I was there. The landlady's daughter is a friend of mine.
You recovered yourself, made your expression apologetic.
Forgive me, lady. My attention was on my breakfast. I'll be sure to watch out next time so as not to miss you.
She snorted, and you went on.
Yes, I did speak with the Lord Direction, Dera. He approached me, wondering if I was from Oenda. I wouldn't have known who he was otherwise.
And what did he want with Moat, I wonder? She asked, folding her arms.
I hardly know,
you told her.
Tell me, lady, is there a secret way out of the fortress, a way to leave with no one knowing?
Is that what you're up to? She didn't unfold her arms, just stood there regarding you sceptically.
They searched the tower and the whole fortress, and he wasn't anywhere.
Your pardon, lady, you said. That wasn't what I asked.
There are no unguarded ways in or out of this fortress, she said. The wall is regularly patrolled, and even the sea is watched. No one saw him leave.
Nonetheless, she continued, as you opened your mouth to argue,
he is not here. Thank you for your assistance, lady.
You bowed your head, just a bit, and turned to go.
Is this how you're spending your time, then?
Her voice was disbelieving, but low, so as not to be overheard by the people passing in the tower yard.
Your lord, dispossessed of the bench, everyone in Vastai unsure what to think about his uncle taking his place, or what the raven might have to say when the egg hatches, or how it might affect the raven's agreement with the forest, let alone what it will mean for Iradin, the directions, all looking for whatever advantage they might get out of this, and you're trying to track down the runaway? Do you believe the Lys fled?
You asked.
I don't think it matters if he did or not,
Tikaz told you.
What matters is that Hipal is Lys now. Nothing's gone the way anyone expected, and Mawat will have to accept that. You can tell him I said so when you see him next.
And when you said nothing.
What did you tell the Lord Dera?
Very little, lady.
You ducked your head again and left. In the square outside the fortress, you looked around at the walls of the adjacent buildings. Flat. No projections or nooks. No booths or sheds creeping into the empty space, as they do in the town's other squares and courts. There was no place to stop or sit. Just flat, yellowish-brown stone paving, warm in the late morning sun. Then you traced your way along the alleys that ran alongside the ditch outside the wall, examining it carefully, surreptitiously. Not staring at it, that would certainly have drawn the attention of one of the guards assigned to patrol the wall, and you were careful not to do that. You passed through the square again, and continued to the wall's other end, where it ran again into the sea by the harbour. The wind blew strong off the water, so that despite the sunshine on the warm sand, you were chilled. Away across the strait, ships crowded the white quays of Ardvustia. A little fleet of fishing boats dotted the waves, and closer in, Several masted ships floated, tied up to pilings, their sails furled. You frowned at them. I don't think you grew up near the sea, and so likely knew very little about boats or tides. You found a place on the sand, well back from the water, and sat and watched the little boats going to and fro, watched as the tide went slowly down and exposed more and more of the broad stone ramp that led out toward where the ships waited. Watched as, one after another, various small sailboats deposited passengers onto the beach, some of them serious-looking older men and women in fine black wool, trailed by servants carrying leather satchels filled with tablets and styluses. Did you remember Dera's words to you earlier about Ardvusktian officials visiting almost daily to consult with Elise? After a while, those sailboats took on a fresh load of passengers and set back out toward Ardvusktia. You watched until the fishing boats came in and hauled their catch up onto the strand. The various people with rights to the catch converged on the fish, among them a handful of kitchen servants from the fortress, and the daughter of your landlady at the guest house.
Your father could not be found, the Lord Radahor had said the day before to Mawat. Not in the tower, not in the fortress, not in the town.
And yet it seemed that he could not have left the fortress without someone knowing. You were thinking about that, it seemed, instead of how Mawat might turn the situation to his own advantage, or what any of this might mean for you. Or perhaps you were thinking of those things, but had for some reason decided to solve this particular puzzle first. After a while, you pushed yourself to your feet and brushed the sand off your legs and returned to the house where you were lodged. The common room was nearly empty at this hour, but the Julans were still there, still sitting at their table so near the fire. One of them recognized you, elbowed one of his companions, and looked pointedly in your direction, said something quiet. The third stood as you drew closer.
Good person, you are on the assistance of the Prince Mawat, I consider.
You stopped and stared, but said nothing.
I am practice my Iridaini,
he said.
I am begging you to sit and drink beer, and I practice to you, if you'll be so kind.
Did you speak to the Lys?
You asked.
Do you have permission to cross?
Ah, said the Julan. He was not particularly tall or particularly short, but his shoulders under the woolen cloak were broad, and his bare arms and legs were well muscled, like an athlete's, or like a soldier's. But he was not carrying a sword, only the sort of small knife anyone might have.
The king is not sent for us today. We stand wait.
You blinked.
We are waiting,
you said.
We are waiting for the Lys to send for us.
The Julan frowned in return, and then smiled.
We are waiting for the Lys to send for us. I am think not send for us today. Sit, friend. Drink with us?
Are we friends?
You asked, and then thought better of it, and moved to sit on a bench across the table from the other two Julans. Stopped and leaned back, just a bit, when the dark brown head of a snake slid out of the armhole of the first Julan's tunic. Its black tongue flickered out, sampling the air.
"'It's only my snake, friend,'
said the Julan.
"'Good snake, nice snake, no worry.'
"'You keep a snake for a pet,' you said, making a fairly good effort to conceal your alarm and puzzlement.
"'Is a friend,'
the Julan smiled widely, held his arm across his chest, and the snake slid farther out. Its body was a lighter brown than its head, and a row of darker brown spots ran down its back.
It wasn't even 3 feet long. It licked the air again.
"He's a good snake. We are not the trouble with the mouse. Sit."
You sat on the bench. The Julan sat beside you.
"Are you being across the water to Advustia?"
he asked. The snake slid back into his tunic.
"No,"
you replied, as he poured you a cup of beer from the earthenware pitcher on the table. You affected not to notice that the snake was still watching you from under his arm, eyes intent and unblinking.
"I've never even been to Vastai before." "But you are on the assistance of the prince."
"I'm the Lord Moat's aide,"
you corrected.
"He's been in the southwest for a few years. I'm from south of here, from the other side of the forest."
"The forest!"
exclaimed the Julan, as the other two looked on, apparently unable to understand their companion's conversation with you.
"Why are you called the forest quiet?" The
interpreter came in, and over to where you were sitting with them.
"Come, speak,"
said the Julan next to you. "Speaking, tell."
"What news?"
"The king will not see you today,"
said the interpreter, also in Tell. From his accent, he was likely Tell himself. A risky proposition for him to come here, but perhaps the Julans had paid him exceptionally well. The Julans would almost certainly have had to travel through Tell territory to get here. Perhaps they had spent some time there. The Julan who had been speaking to you appeared to speak Tell fairly well, after all. Their interpreter, having delivered his message, the three Julans conversed briefly among themselves in a language that was neither Tell nor Iridani. Then,
"Who did you speak to?"
asked the Julan sitting beside you, speaking Tell again. You looked only at your cup of beer. The interpreter glanced at you quickly, then back to the Julan beside you.
"I spoke to the councillor. He said that the king had other priorities and might send for you tomorrow, or might not."
"This delay is fine for now," said the Julan beside you. "But if it goes on too long, we'll have to wait till next spring to go much farther north, if what you say about the ice and cold is true."
"I think he wants more gifts," said the interpreter. "The ones you have already given have made him greedy. They're like that here."
The Julan beside you turned to you and said in Iridani,
"The king is not see us today, I am hearing." "No?"
You seemed unperturbed and only mildly surprised at the news. "That's inconvenient for you. How long have you been here?"
4 weeks,
said your Julan companion. "The king before would not see us at all, so it's better, but we like to go."
"Why?"
you asked. The Julan blinked at you, seeming perplexed.
"I heard what your interpreter said,"
you told him,
"in the tower, that you only want to write about your travels for the people back home. That doesn't seem like it would be worth all this."
"Ah, friend, you are not a person that is... I am not know the word."
He turned to the interpreter and said in Tell, "What is the word, someone who travels to see and learn new things?" The interpreter shrugged, suggested in Iridani,
"Traveler, wanderer, discoverer,"
and then back to Tell.
"None of them is exactly right."
"Discoverer," decided the Julan, "for a person who is live to discover is worth the most, the everything, to see a new thing. That we are no more about the world."
You stared at him skeptically.
"You brought a god with you, just to walk around away up north and discover?"
"Ah," said the Julan, as though you had caught him out in some small deception.
But our snake friend is not at all a very large god, and discover is need. How do you say we are need food and travel and clothing and guess for where people are help us? The more we are travel, the more all these things, and we are travel long and far. We are not so rich, friend, that we are have all this ourselves, but it may be that there is gold in the north, and we are here that it may be, so we are discover if it is, and bring that news to someone who will give us all these things for our discover. You see?
Plainly, you did.
You aren't just looking for whatever you can find. You're looking for anything valuable you can find, and a safe route to bring it back to Jula.
Ah, you are understand,
agreed the Jolan.
And this is good for everyone, I am think. We discover as we are wish. If we are find gold or other things, the person who is support us discovering has as they are wish. And if we are bring gold or other things through Vastai, the king is take his share, yes? Good for everyone.
Until Jula decides they don't want to share any of that gold, or other things, whatever those may be?
Oh, friend,
said the Julan reprovingly,
Jula is very far away. And it may be no gold at all.
He gave you a more carefully considering look.
So, the Prince Amawat, is he...
He searched for a word or a phrase.
Is the people of Ira then to love him?
He's the heir to the lease, you said, apparently uncomprehending.
Yes, agreed the Julan pleasantly.
That is not the people love him. I am consider. If Prince Mawat is want to be king, the people will help him, or the...
He paused here, evidently searching for a word.
Is a god a friend of the prince?
You looked at him with disbelief.
He's the heir to the lease.
Yes, yes.
The Julan waved your protest away.
And here in Vastai one god is ruling, but always gods are.
Still standing beside the table, the interpreter said in Tell,
and ravens are assholes. But don't say that. You can't say that here without starting trouble.
The Julan said as though the interpreter had not spoken.
A god, that is small now, is maybe not small forever. With the right friends.
Were you puzzled by this statement? You were born on a farm, south of the Silent Forest. You've likely never knowingly met a small god there. But you'll almost certainly have sprinkled a few drops of milk onto the ground just before leaving it to separate. Or perhaps there was a stone by a well that you wetted when you were sent to draw water, or a rhyme that you said while filling your pail, some animal your family doesn't eat.
We don't have small gods in Iriden,
you said, a shade indignantly.
If you want small gods, visit the Tell in the south. They have nothing but.
The interpreter frowned, but said nothing in response.
Small gods everywhere, said the Julan. In Iraden they hide. They might want a king who allows them not to hide, and the prince is not seem happy with the king.
He's the lease, you said.
And you don't understand anything about Iriden. You made as if to stand up. The Julan laid his hand on your forearm.
No offense, friend, no offense. I am consider I say a bad thing, although I am not mean to. No offense.
No offense, you agreed, but coldly, with a pointed look at his hand on your arm, which he withdrew. The snake under his arm licked the air again, tongue flickering, as you rose and left.